You did the workshop Solidarity in Times of Climate Disasters in our project. Welcome and thank you for being here.
Yes, thank you, Fina, for having me.
Before we dive in, could you shortly introduce yourself and what you do? What is your focus?
So my name is Payal Parekh. I'm from Mumbai, India, but I moved to Europe as a climate scientist at the University of Bern in Switzerland, and I quickly realized that the problem we have around climate is not a scientific problem, but it's a political one, and so I decided to make the shift and become a full-time activist, working to stop the fossil fuel industry and to ensure that we have climate justice, because we, as you mentioned, those who are least responsible are the most impacted by the climate crisis.
When we started the project, we had some more general discussions about the wording, like crisis, disaster, and how these are political terms that can also be instrumentalized, and they're very subjective also, and also depend on the context, and so on and so forth. When it comes to climate disasters and climate crisis, what are your thoughts and reflections on which terms you use? And maybe which terms you do not use and why?
Yeah, Fina, it's a really good question because we know that language shapes how we think about something, and that it can also invoke feelings or invoke actions that maybe are not favorable. But I believe that using the words disaster and crisis, in particular crisis, is quite useful because it lets us or forces us to accept that what we're dealing with is very serious and that we can't avoid it, we can't ignore it, but at the same time that we can act, that it's not a fait accompli. And for that reason, I do like to use the word a crisis because many of us have in our personal lives also had a crisis. And it's while it's uncomfortable and it's difficult, you can get out of it. There is another side. I don't tend to use the word disaster very much myself, but that might be because my training was as first a geologist and then a climate scientist. And so when I think about disasters, I think a lot about geological disasters. But I very much like the word crisis because it's at the level we need to be, but it's not taking away our ability to act and get out of it.
And in that way, it's also, I think like part of why we started with this project was also a shift, which has been very present before also of people like not calling it a crisis so much, but then rather saying it's a collapse, we're facing collapse, right? Which takes away more the agency, but also stresses the urgency, no?
Exactly. And that was what I wanted to get into, but I was a bit nervous to use the word collapse on the podcast. It's exactly that. And, collapse comes from the Latin collabi, which really means just to fall on top of each other. And there you really have an image of a building falling, unfortunately, such as what we've been seeing in Gaza or after the World Trade Center was hit, or when there's an earthquake and a building completely collapses, and then it's over. And that's why I very much prefer the word crisis to the collapse, because the collapse is it's gone. And of course, even in a crisis there, when you get out of it, you may not be the same. It may not be the same as it was before, but you are able to still take the building blocks and create something new. And when it's a collapse, it's completely gone. So that's also why I it's exactly for that reason that I prefer the word crisis.
Disaster seems also like a political term or like a subjective term more, like what is like a disaster, right? But at the same time, yeah, it always has these advantages and disadvantages of like stressing its importance and at the same time. So that's why I thought like you chose the word disaster on purpose.
So I think it was chosen before I joined the project. And I could imagine that it was done also because you always will talk about these natural disasters, you know, when there's an earthquake, when there's a typhoon, and then this idea that there has to be solidarity and support. And so from that perspective, I don't think it's so bad because it's in, from that perspective, it's very good that, you know, Red Cross will make appeals for people to donate money, donate materials. And from that perspective, this sense of solidarity, I think, is very good. But on the other hand, because we speak often about natural disasters as if we can't control it and it happens. And of course, when it comes to climate disasters, we know who is responsible. And on the other hand, when I was the program director at 350.org, an international campaigning organization, we started to give the names of extreme weather events, the names of fossil fuel companies or the CEO of fossil fuel companies, so that saying, well, you're responsible for this, so it should be named after you. And so from that perspective, I think disaster is also can be very useful when you take it a further step to talk about accountability. And with regards to solidarity, I do think it's good because all around the world, when there is a quote unquote natural disaster, which if we talk 100 years ago, when a typhoon happened, it was unlikely due to CO2, but just because of chaos in the natural system, there was solidarity, and we do want to have solidarity. So I do think both of these words are much better than collapse. And what we're facing right now is things are decaying. We are in a slow decay, and then there's moments of spikes. And I think that is very different than a collapse where it happens all at once, or like a Hollywood film with the snowball effect, and suddenly we've got 48 hours and then the world ends. That's not the case. And along this decay, despite maybe having chances that aren't as good as 10 years ago, we still have got chances to make a switch and to make a change and to improve the situation. And in a collapse, for me, it's all about being game over.
In your workshops, you talked about moving through feelings also. What does this look like in this case? And what does it mean in the context of the topic of climate disasters, climate crisis? And why is this skill set relevant for how we look at so-called crisis and for facing upcoming crisis?
When we only look at a situation, in particular a situation that is really challenging to us, or try to look at it from an intellectual standpoint, and we don't sit with our feelings, it usually doesn't turn out very well. And I'm definitely not, you know, I was a scientist, I'm not the touchy-feely type, but in a crisis or after a disaster in India, I have helped out after race riots, after the tsunami in 2004 after an earthquake in 2001. We are in a situation where our back is against the wall. It's uncomfortable. We don't know it before. And if you can't name what you're feeling, it's really hard to respond in a way that's helpful to you as well as helpful to people around you. And often, if the first time that you're trying to name what you're feeling and also trying to observe how you react when you're feeling that, it can be very difficult to show solidarity or be useful. And that's why we really suggest that people do this in their daily life, that when you get into a situation that's a little bit, just a little bit uncomfortable, that you start to say, oh shit, okay, how am I feeling? Oh, my hands are clamming up. My stomach is, I'm getting that, you know, the butterflies in the stomach, but not like because I'm in love, but because I'm stressed, or I'm suddenly feeling really tired or really sad. So that you can practice saying, okay, I see that I'm feeling that way. Can I develop strategies on my own? Strategies that work for me, because each of us is different, that can help me sit with that feeling, pass through that feeling. And maybe it's best shown with an example. And I can say that I'm a very impatient person. And so if I'm say I'm waiting for an important phone call or an email to come in, I start to think about how everything is going to go wrong, become very pessimistic. And I also I can't sit calmly. I need to pace back and forth. But just being able to name it, that, okay, I'm nervous about what the answer could be, and say, maybe I can take a few deep breaths, and maybe instead of thinking about all the reasons why this can't work out, maybe understand why the person maybe, you know, the person's busy with other stuff, or maybe they've gotten an unexpected phone call, whatever it is. And these sound like minor things, but you have to practice. The only way you can get out of that is you can practice, so that when you are in a bigger situation, you've already been practicing how to keep yourself calm. Or perhaps it's the situation where you realize, like, oh, okay, after this disaster, one of the things that, after big disasters in my region, one of the things that's often needed is somebody that is really organized and can create very quickly an Excel table of where there's emergency shelters. And I'm not capable in that situation to do that. So that should not be a task that I take on. On the other hand, I'm very good at sitting with people who feel really shocked by what's happened, and I'm good at listening to them. So these are the reasons why, and it's not to fight against what you're not able to do well in a crisis situation. It's to get to know yourself better and learn strategies that work for you, because what works for you may not work for someone else. And to actually, you are best able to serve your community when you know what you can and can't offer in that situation.
It's funny, we discovered before that we both have spent some time in Paso, and I always have to think of the one moment when I was there, when there was like a, how do you call that? Like
the flooding.
A flooding, which was like, it's called like, yeah, tausend flut, like, what is it called?
Once in a thousand
years. Yes, yeah, flood. La la la.
Yeah.
So it was like a very high flood, and I remember that, like, in that moment, I was sick before, and then the moment this happened, I was not sick anymore. I was just like on autopilot. I was working. I was so full of adrenaline. I was helping out here and there, la la la. So, and my personal feelings didn't matter so much in that moment at all. So I think like the whole situation of like anxieties before and being scared about the future, like for me, this moment also gave me the security that once it's gonna be here, once it's gonna happen, once a crisis is there, I can trust that, it would just like, we would just work together. And at the same time, yeah, I think like there was also some people who have deeply suffered throughout this event and also like in the aftermath, and there has been suicides and there has been, you know, so I think like all of this means also that we didn't care enough about what people were feeling because of this event.
I think what's interesting is how as humans we can experience the same thing and process it differently or react to it differently, and that's great to know that, you know, you're one of those people that will just say, okay, I'm on it, it doesn't matter how I was feeling before. And you know, I think a lot of people that work in international aid or disaster relief tend to be like that, and what I hear from them is what's important though is after the adrenaline's not there to that people start to feel empty. How do you deal with that? And so I think that's why it's so important, because each of us, we really are individuals and everyone has a different way of dealing, and that for some people in that moment they need more support, some people after it's passed. And I think that's also in a way what makes me feel as if humanity is worth saving, because of course I don't like animals that much. I'm not that into them, but I'm really into nature and ecosystems and stuff. But at the end of the day, it's about saving us. And I think it's this diversity of being one species, yet people respond so differently. And I think that's actually something to celebrate. And that's why it's worth us working through these crises and coming out in a way that's better. And that's, I guess, another key point I'd like to bring in is, you know, you read the quote from us about how we need to keep fighting the industry. We need to fight for an economy that is socially and ecologically and economically just. And we, at the same time, we need to fight these crises. And I want to see us using these crises in order to build power, to have the structural and systemic change that we so badly need, that they shouldn't go to waste, that they can be, you know, they can be an opportunity at times for good.
Thank you. Now we've been on a more like, we've been very abstract with the terms, then we've been more concrete with the feelings. Can we make it even more concrete for our listeners? How do I prepare? How can we make a plan not only for ourselves, but also for our collectives? Be it a family, flat share, political group, community, whatever we're mean, our surrounding means. Could you maybe give us a couple of very specific examples how to prepare and scenarios that may be useful?
I want to start out with saying that it's always great to be in a group, in a collective, working together. But if we're really talking about solidarity, and for the moment, let's talk about solidarity in your nearby surroundings, is to really think about who are the people that are most marginalized or disenfranchised, or for maybe health reasons might need more support. And the reason I bring this up is, I think for everybody in Europe, but especially those in probably Germany, know about the Ahrtal, where, you know, I think what was over 150 people died, maybe even more. But, you know, you had a home for people with physical and mental disabilities, and I think over a dozen people, they couldn't get them out fast enough. And that's an example of that. That should have been the highest priority. And because they cannot leave on their own, and there has to be more support. Therefore, for me, making a plan is really to think about who are the highest priorities and who is it that you want to serve, and in which way can you do that? Another example that for me is important is after the tsunami in 2004, friends and I from Mumbai, we took the train, like, I don't know, 30 hours or more to southern India because we wanted to help. And in the case of India, because we've had so many disasters, the army is actually very, very good at doing short-term relief and rescue. And we were completely useless. We were, like, in the way. We had never learned how to do anything like that before. And so we were totally useless.
That's funny that you bring it up, because for my experience in Pasal, again, like at the flood that I was talking about, it was the complete opposite. Like, we were all there with our, what's it called, Gummistiefel?
Yeah, your like, rubber boots.
Rubber boots, yeah. And, like, I don't know. Yeah, like doing
shoveling,
yes.
Sandbags, yeah.
Doing all of that. And then after, I don't know, it felt like ages, then the military showed up and we were like, who are you? Like, they were like acting as if they could tell us what to do now. And it was really annoying. It was really annoying. It was really like, who are you? Get the fuck out. Like, not only as an anti-military person, as an anti-authoritarian person, I'm an anarchist, I'm like, get the fuck out of here. But also, like, looking at what we had already created and how they kind of, like, were way too late and dissolved or, like, destroyed the whole, the ambience, the atmosphere, everything.
Yeah. But that's why the context is important, right? But where we were helpful is like when these international groups like International Red Cross and aid groups came, and then they started separating people in the refugee sites, or I guess, yeah, refugee sites, I guess we can call them, based on caste, because the fisher people did not want to be with the Dalits, who are the considered the untouchables. And there, it was similar to your example then,
yeah.
Like, oh, you're supposed to be the experts on this. And we're like, this is not acceptable. And of course, because also most of their staff was not from South Asia, so we're not used to dealing with caste. And we were also then telling them what you're doing, that's not possible. And all I want to say with this is one, to realize where, almost like doing a mapping of your group, what skills do you have or what skills don't you have but you would like to have, and what are the skills of the other actors, and which ones are good, which ones don't do it very well, like in this case in Passau in southern Germany, the military wasn't particularly useful, so that you're prepared to be able to do that and do that really well. And of course, there are situations where everybody has to step in and you just have to do it. But the more you in advance think about what is it that we can offer and do really well, or we see there's a gap and we want to fill that gap, that you prepare for it. So there are groups such as CADOS in Germany that is independently organized, I think more along lines of anarchist principles for doing humanitarian aid, and have learned a lot of the skills that we often think that the state or the military or big organizations like the Red Cross have. And of course, they are, because of their political values, they professionally offer the same, but in a very different way. And so it's totally possible for people to do that. It's just a matter of not taking on something in which you could actually endanger people because you haven't prepared well.
In one of our preparational talks on inclusive disaster management, what they call it, one of our hosts, our input givers, Friedrich Gabel, was also talking about how this is a huge gap, huge lack, as you said. And it starts with very small things, which I didn't think about before, but it's super obvious that people who are in a wheelchair with electronic wheelchair, for example, that they the health insurance doesn't pay for a second backup battery, so to say, you know? So in case there's electricity is lacking, they very fast run out of battery for getting somewhere, you know? So this is something that we could, for example, think of how, very specifically preparing also. And also, as you mentioned, in the Ahrtal, that people were not really, that it wasn't possible to get people out fast enough. So the other day I was giving a workshop as well with a person who's a wheelchair user, and she said that in the university that she's working at in Berlin, the fire protection that she was introduced to basically said in case of fire, you open the window, you stand by the window, you sit by the window, you wait by the window, and hope that the firefighters come fast enough because then you are not supposed to use the elevators anymore. And then they had to came up with alternatives and so on. But this is basically the disaster management or protection or crisis prevention that people are coming up with. And this then is, open a window, wait, hope somebody will come.
And this is why two things. One, it's really important that people that are from these groups are involved in the planning because they see things we don't see, right? I mean, I have never lived thus far in my life in a wheelchair, so I don't know. Although I can at least notice that's really ridiculous. And also, you're not supposed to use the lift, which is also understandable, but then there has to be a plan B, right? And I think, secondly, it's actually a chance for collectives before the disaster to also be very political and to make demands, right? To either say, okay, we're going to fill the gap, or we're going to force the state, or we're going to force institutions that they have to already have a plan in place. And this is what I found very interesting is there's the group of flood survivors in the UK who have come together to form an organization, and they have chapters in many towns in the UK. And it's actually about the aftermath of floods. What do they have access to? How will their communities build flood barriers or not? And I think this is what we have to do in terms of ensuring that the way in which we deal with crises and disasters is just, is based on solidarity, and also be able to create the conditions that we can finally get climate protection, because otherwise we are in a devil's loop, because the longer we don't have climate protection, the worse the impacts get, and then we're just stuck always responding to the impacts and not getting out of that loop to actually come to a new steady state.
Okay, thank you so much. I hope that also for our listeners there was some interesting impulses and foods for thought, as we say. I think there was lots of interesting materials there and thoughts and perspectives. Thank you so much for your time and for sharing. You can also find our presentations, readers, handbook, more interesting podcast episodes and follow-up materials from the workshop that Payal was part of at our website www.skillsforcrisis.org. Thank you so much and goodbye.